Welcome to Holistic Matters, the podcast that's designed to help you become the you that nature intended. I'm excited about today's discussion and podcast. In a recent meeting, I had a chance to meet Dr. Eric Jackson, who has an interesting background, both as a plant geneticist and as a plant anthropologist. It's like amazing. Now, many of you are probably scratching your head thinking, well, what does that do? Well, here's a little bit of insight that I'm looking forward to learning more about, and that's the whole concept of what happened in the processing techniques of grains in particular and other fruits and vegetables, as an example, that may have changed the nutrient density or the density of phytoactives. And we'll go back and review the longstanding history of what that process resulted in and what it looked like. But first, Dr. Jackson, thanks very much for taking the time to join us today. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, your background, your training, and 25-2 Solutions and the company that you're the founder and CEO of.
Yeah, so my background started in graduate school in plant pathology, actually, as a master's in plant pathology. And before that, I came out of studying to get a pre-medicine degree. And so then I read a book based on interns called Intern Blues and realized that my affinity and emotional attachment to the patients was probably not going to be a good thing, John. So I realized I was going to have to do something else. So I departed away from that. And my advisor, really good person, just as all educators mostly are, steered me into plant pathology just for my two passions. And so then I got involved in that and then quickly became a student of genetics during the dawn of genetics. And kind of back in the day, if I date myself, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of became a student of genetics and then statistical genomics. So kind of as an emerging field and started to study just the relationship of genes and how they get expressed in environments in plants. And it was a lot easier to do in plants because I always told people that I could grow out thousands of plants and kill a bunch and nobody cared. And I didn't
that's
care.
Right, the screen, right?
That's right. That's right. And then that kind of morphed out when I took my first job. Actually, it was a joint postdoctoral fellowship between Texas A&M and the USDA and studying oat of all crops, right? A very forgotten crop. I guess I would call it the unfortunate stepchild of the grain world. And also barley, which is probably the other not so unfortunate, but a little, because of the brewing industry, but other unfortunate stepchild as far as from the nutrient standpoint. And so then I really got into the world of genomic model or predictive modeling and forecasting and how that intersects with the genomics and the expression of alleles in environments or genes in environments that bring about everything we see, whether it's the agronomic potential of yield, disease resistance, or the nutrient composition that we care about when we eat the grains, as human beings. And so that kind of brought me back to where I was and started working on at that time wanting to understand everything I could understand about what oat was. And I didn't know a whole lot about oat other than that it was a horse feed and an oatmeal. I didn't know the connection between even where it became a horse feed versus an oatmeal or vice versa. Or why it fell off of being a horse feed even in our own country today. And so really studying that, I came across my mentor, Rick Jellin, who's the head of the Department of Life Sciences at Brigham Young University, who was the first person that I would ever have classified as an oat anthropologist, cared to know everything there was to know about the history and origin of oat. Most people might not get excited about that, but it was pretty interesting to me to kind of uncover, the idea that this crop that most people know is a very healthy food source from, whether it's Quaker oatmeal or Cheerios, right? It puts a heart on the side of a box and most people know a lower cholesterol. Right, right. Like, why is that? And where did it come from? And the reality is that nobody really knows where it came from, right? We don't even know where the ancestral progenitors are from. Right. Most people believe, I think the major people in the world that know most about it today would say that it's probably buried at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah, so that's fascinating. So, oat is a great example of, let's say, the grains that have probably change the most in profile or has a different profile than what most people would think that it has. Right. It's probably makes up somewhere in the neighborhood of probably 5% market share of all cereals. So it's a popular product, but yet one of the things that you hear a lot of people in the integrative healthcare world talk about is that as may be true with all grains, and that'll be one of the questions I have for you here, as it's maybe true with all grains, somehow the Mendelian genetics and breeding of these crops have changed so much so that we've lost a little bit of the intended or the original nutrient profile. So you mentioned oats. I mean, going back into probably what sounds to me a couple thousand years ago or beyond that. Walk us through a little bit of kind of what you discovered as you kind of went around the world. And
so, John, I think the one thing that taught me the most about this and kind of changed my outlook on the world, when I was working with the U.S. government and the USDA, Rick actually pointed me to a species of oat that was discovered in 1960s by a gentleman named Gideon Ladizinski, who was what we would consider a pioneer. So most people don't realize this, but Thomas Jefferson has a farm in Monticello, right? And if you go to his farm, on the wall on his farm, one of the walls that's attributed to this is one of the quotes from his memoirs. It says, "There's no greater service that can be rendered a country than to provide a useful crop to its culture, particularly a bread grain," he actually says on that wall. And if you look at that, it wasn't until, some hundred years later when Abraham Lincoln instituted the 1890s Act, right? And he established the land grant institutions, if I'm correct on that. He actually also established the idea that we need to send plant pioneers out into the world. And through that process, they established very large collections of the genetic diversity of all these crops that we grow, whether it's corn or soybeans, or oats or barley or wheat. I mean, I ask the question to a lot of kids sometimes, so what crop do we eat in a major row crop or any even specialty crops in the United States that actually come from the United States, the North American continent? Mm-hmm. And the answer is none, right?
Not even corn.
So corn's from South America or from Central America. So Tiasente and comes out of Central America. And so that's the closest though, John, you're right. Yeah. But yet soybean, China, you know, all of our grains, the Middle East. And so so they're very astute in sending out these plant pioneers to go capture or recapture the genetic diversity. And even Thomas Jefferson, as we talked earlier, he was one of the, 10 years after the revolution, he was in other countries doing this work. And I think it was cool that Abraham Lincoln then captured that after that and established this. And so Gideon Ladizinski was one of these plant pioneers that had gone out and was trying to search for this ancient ancestry of oat. And he stumbled upon a wild species of oat. The oat is in the genus Avena. So as a scientist, you look at oat, common oat, and you say Avena sativa, genus and species, in the nomenclature of the actual plant. And he stumbled upon a species, so it's Avena magna, not Avena sativa. And he thought it was one of the ancestors of oat. It was on the Iberian Peninsula, which is just the southern part of Spain, and its origin was out of Morocco. And which is one of the two centers of origin of oat. One would be in Turkey, the other one, or Mesopotamia, and the other one would be in Morocco. And so on this side, he was in the Morocco side, and he discovered this oat, and he determined that it wasn't actually Avena, the ancestor to Avena sativa, common oat as we eat it today, but it was actually another species that was already identified. What he noticed about this oat, though, that it was very high in protein, double the protein of common oat. Common oat's usually about 21% of the total grain is protein, or 12% of the grain is protein, made up of protein. The other is all starch mainly, and some fibers, some fat. But this oat had upwards of 25% protein. And so he got super excited about that. And he spent the next 30 years to 40 years of his career trying to take the genes out of that for protein and put it into common oat, the Avena sativa species. Yeah. And not only him, he actually provided that material to some of the leading oat breeders across North America and in Europe. And they all spent a lot of time trying to extract the genes that would then render common oat to have very high protein. And so after those processes and several years, they weren't able to capture that protein back. When I started with the U.S. government, back in 2004 now, so almost, you do the math on that one, kind of dating myself, back in 2004, the wild, hairy specimen that's Avena magna was brought to me by Rick Jelen and the story of Gideon Ladizinski. So I started what was then a 13 to 14 year quest to domesticate this variety, only putting selection pressure on what we call the domestication syndrome, genes that would enable the plant to stand upright, to not be too tall, to not shatter all of its seed off onto the ground before you could harvest it, to remove this dense hair that's around this seed to where it looked like a polished little grain that you could actually run through a mill and extract the groat, which is the edible portion of the plant.
When did this start happening in the early 1900s?
So when did all that would
1930s?
Occur? Yeah. So all the hair and everything else on the side of the
out, because that's when kind of the, if you will, the industrialization of farming.
That would have been
started.
Actually back in the Agrarian days, thousands of years ago.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
People would have done this with bread, wheat, barley, and oats.
Okay.
So this would have been
like
back way back
400 or 500,
yep.
600.
Yeah.
AD.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah, wow.
Exactly.
Wow.
And so, but some of the wild species, the ancestral species, never were domesticated.
Uh-huh.
And so this Avena magna was one of those types. So oat is made up of several different species, actually. It's not just one singular unit.
Right.
So this was one of the species, the off types, that was very wild, untainted by any hands of breeding or anything else, which is a perfect specimen if you wanted to study kind of what did the crop look like in its natural habitat, right?
Here is
oat in its natural habitat. And so taking that and walking it through the domestication process, I was also very intrigued, in our group was very intrigued by some of the other questions we have. Why could not these very, very intelligent breeders and plant physiologists and these people that had tackled this problem of converting common oat into a high protein oat using the genetics from this wild species through crossing, why couldn't they get the job done?
Right.
And what I stumbled upon, you know, and our team had stumbled upon is we realized that there was a simple gene which would be analogous to a key that when a plant's leaf tissue, so a plant will pull nutrients up from the soil, it'll pull the minerals and vitamins and different things up from the soil. And then it'll make things in its leaf whenever it goes through photosynthesis, fixing carbon. It'll make things. It'll make like amino acids and different constituents of the leaf while it's packing in all these dense nutrients, right? These vitamins and minerals it's bringing up from the soil. And that's why mom always said, eat your vegetables, the fleshy part of the plant, right? Unfortunately, those vegetables, and I would argue with my mom, well, but it's 90% water, mom. So just hydrate it down into some powder and let me just drink it really quickly, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, that wouldn't work, so you'd have to take on that portion of eating the leafy green. But in a grain crop, whenever it goes to dry down and produce its seed, its
right.
embryo, it would basically in a natural habitat, a natural form, what was happening is this key would unlock these gates, what I would like the gatekeepers to the highway of the
right.
plant that would be the highway to take all these minerals to the actual embryo and store it in the grain, right?
Right, right.
And what this key did, it would lock all those nutrients, those good things, to be able to move to the grain. And what happened was, is somewhere during the way of domestication, you know, the idea was, is I need to get more and more yield. I need more and more yield. And I always like to say the path of least resistance is usually the path that comes to the surface. And so what I believe happened, and this is what I believe happened, is some Agrarian agriculturalist, you know, some old world farmer, found a variant where that key was no longer working.
Wow.
It disrupted that key. And what happened was, is that key wouldn't unlock those gates, all those vitamins and neutrals, you know, nutrients got catabolized and broken down and put back into either the soil, or they were converted into carbons into sugars.
Yeah,
and then that sugar got pumped through the vessel,
right.
the vascular system, up to the grain. And then the grain just got to fill fast, right? So what does it do? It takes its best storage opportunity because it's all about producing an embryo and providing all the things that embryo needs to grow fast. And well, that embryo just needs a lot of sugar or oil.
Yeah, right. So all of a sudden the sugar kind of gets translated to a kind of a better tasting grain or better tasting sweet bread.
To starch.
Or
it gets converted to starch,
right.
The storage molecule for the embryo.
Right.
So it's going to be starch or oil.
Yeah.
Oils in the case
right.
of our oilseed crops. To give that embryo fast energy
right.
Until it can produce leaves to photosynthesize. And so that's what happened in the case of this oat. And so so what was happening is when these breeders would take that key and put it back in to the common oat today, well, there's been 1,000 years of evolution that's occurred with no selection pressure on the locks. Well, now you've got 52 or some odd hundred of locks that are changed where the key doesn't
right.
fit it anymore.
Right. Right.
So imagine now I had the master key, but I no longer works because all the locks are different.
But so did that whole process get even more exaggerated toward like the unfavorable by the need just to kind of commercialize our farming capabilities. Let's use kind of the traditional oat, and then by further accident, we kind of bred out some of the greater nutrient qualities of the grains.
Yeah, and you think about that. I mean, so one, we bred out a lot of the nutritional value just by going after more plump grain and yield, right? Yeah. But it wasn't because there was this evil empire of people that were trying to do something bad. And actually, when you think about where the biggest probably impact was made was back before there was even industrialization occurred. And then it's just been carried on further down the road. But I do think as now you start to think, and John, we talked about this, if you look at like the molecules that are involved in disease resistance or things like that in particular, how do you grow a plant in an environment where there's lots of diseases that, like us, they want to eat that same part of the plant, and they're going to favor sugars or things that taste good, and they're not going to like things that are bitter. And a lot of times the bitter compounds are compounds that are active, bioactive against these kind of these pests, if you want to call it that. And so then you're going to increase the amounts of bitter compounds in theory, while you're reducing the compounds that are less bitter and less caustic and are sweeter, right? And so then what happens in the industrial age and things like this is you can't put an oat crop or a wheat crop or anything else into a product that's highly bitter.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to add things back to it, like salts and sugars and things like that to make it taste good, right? So people like that kind of thing, right?
So in our own clinical work, we identified really two important insights I think that exist is an understanding, number one, that the body itself has bitter receptors, about 34 bitter receptors up and down the alimentary tract, that our digestive tract, and that specialized species or strains, I should say, of oats have more bitter compounds. And so if you combine these bitter compounds with the bitter receptors, now as it turns out, and what we've been able to demonstrate in the clinic, is that you get a more balanced, sustainable glucose control, and that you can imagine, right, as an extension, helps avoid the development of obesity, helps avoid the development of diabetes and, you know, other chronic disease states. But that was kind of hard to come by and connect the dots. And now, you know, some of the discussions that we're learning from you is, you know, you can get back into great Mendelian genetics and breeding and actually breed and strengthen that profile of seed so that it has more bitter compounds so it can have a greater effect and be healthy for you again.
Yeah, exactly, John. I think the part that exciting, I think we live in, you know, a lot of times people say that we, you know, this has got to, the times now are worse than they were 50 years ago. And I always like to say, no, the time that you live in is the time that you live in. But I would argue from my perspective, from the aspect of knowledge gain and multidisciplinary avenues and when applied to a problem, I mean, we make huge gains and we live in a time where that's happening, right? And I think one of the things that I would push back on to what you said, if I had a biochemistry professor in undergraduate that told the story of the gentleman that was working during the Civil War on sulfur drugs.
Yeah.
And he actually treated his daughter for a gangrene infection with the sulfur compound that he was working on. And it worked, cured her.
Yeah.
And he published it in a biochemistry journal. And nobody read it because biologists don't read biochemistry journals, right?
Right.
Chemistry journals is what he used to say. And think about the time of the Civil War all the way to the advent of penicillin and the lives that were lost because we didn't cross function our disciplines.
Yeah.
And I think if you go back even deeper, John, and you read the story of Ashley Ambrose, Undaunted Courage, with Meriwether Lewis is talking about Sacagawea or Sacagawea if you're from out west. And he tells the story of her getting very ill and needing to go back to her ancestral waters. And he almost was making fun of the ancestral waters and the days away, but they were going to do it because he felt she was going to die. And as the story goes, they get to the ancestral waters and they smelt a putrid sulfur is what his documentation said. And it wasn't, he thought that she would be dead within a series of days. And it wasn't much after that that he writes in his journal that she's miraculously been healed.
Yeah.
So you think now about all the time of the great movement of Meriwether Lewis, and Lewis and Clark expedition, and they would have discovered an antibiotic. But nobody could read between the lines. So I come back to that comment of what you just said and the importance that I think in the educational system of transdisciplinary sciences merging together and coming together to work on some of these grand challenge problems. And the one you're talking about is huge. Like we have the ability in plant breeding today to use predictive analytics and genomics, not necessarily to go in and edit genes or, you know, go in and block gene transcription, but we have the ability to guide our breeding practice, right? Yeah. To be precision, to be laser accurate on what crosses we make and what we measure. And so what you're saying is, like, science is like what your team has done is allowing us to go back and say, let's not make the mistakes of the past, right? I think it's interesting. It says, you know, what's the great adage in the history? If you don't like history, it's like, well, if you don't study history, then you're destined to make the same mistake.
Yeah, right.
And I think the reality is, if we look at what we've been talking about today, it's like we know now that that we could have had very nutrient-dense crops if we had just tracked all those as well as yield at the same time. I don't believe the agronomists, the breeders, would have made those mistakes if they would have had the tools that we have today.
Right.
And I think now what you're saying is we have this knowledge. We have transdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, how you want to look at it, where we can measure these things and we can add those to these great things like genomics and predictive analytics to guide our breeding and hybridization strategies to where we can retain these things that are beneficial to the human body and not delete them or remove them or things like this.
Yeah, that's what makes, in my mind, healthcare today so exciting, and a holistic approach toward healthcare is that opportunity to understand the power of plants and the impact that selected nutrients and or phytonutrients can have on health outcomes.
Right.
And so it's not that they never existed, they did, but we've got to breed them back into it in a legitimate, natural way that can actually make a big difference.
Yeah.
And so, you know, today you mentioned the concept of genomics. You know, there's this metabolomics, genomics, nutrigenomics, all these genomics, omics words. And I today like to refer to it in general as health omics. And health omics is the discipline of all those coming together in a way, but it starts with understanding what's the strain that you're starting with for any particular plant, what's its own individual strength as a nutrient profile, and then can you grow those?
Yeah.
And then make sure that people have access and eat them.
Yeah, and I think that's where it gets me excited is you start to learn, too, that a lot of times it's, I love, what was it, the great astronomer,
Galileo?
No, back, it was just recent to that in Ithaca up in Cornell. Voyager spacecraft. I can't believe it's slipping my mind now. It's simpler than that. But anyway, he's the pale blue dot, referring to the pale blue dot. And he wrote a dissertation after he saw the pale blue dot. Can't believe that just slipped my mind. Sorry. But he talks about the idea that science is a humbling, astronomy in itself is a very humbling discipline. And I think the science in general can be very, it could cause a lot of humility in a scientist if the scientist is allowing of it. And one of the things that I capture from that is with all these sophisticated technologies, the one thing that I'm learning is that you turn it around and it's already existing in nature somewhere, right?
That's
the powerful thing.
Yeah.
And I think it really is powerful. And I always say be leery of the voice with no opposition, especially when it's your own. And I think one of the things that being in science and being in the industry, because I had worked in the industry as well for 6 years, is the idea that all industry is bad or all people's opinions are stupid, right, that are opposing to yours. And really they're not. And I think in general, when people are nervous about some of these things like rapid, you know, use of technology to get to an end, maybe it's not right. Maybe we should stop and say, maybe there is some logic in the things that are being said out there, if the masses are saying it, or even if there's pockets of opposition, we should be astute to that. So if you go back and you look at that, what I've started to learn is we could use all these sophisticated tools like you're saying, and we can go back and we can see that, man, it already existed. And all we needed to do was be able to, like you said, grow it in a specific location, but not change it outside of that and allow that natural process. Because one of the things that I think is very astute about this is that there's been a lot of years of coevolution, you know, where people have eaten plants over a lot of numbers of years before we were ever here.
Right.
And to say that nature didn't have a way of doing that really, really well, I think is pretty egotistical, right?
Like
on our part,
that
we are needed in this process somehow. We're mainly a herbivore of a plant. And so the reality is that that plant is also a nutrient source for us. And so there's been a lot of years where those plants were ripe for us to be eating. And I think it's really cool if once we start to uncover the genomics and genetics and all this stuff, we're starting to learn that we can use those as tools to bring. So you can use it for two things. I think the two things that we look at is you can use all these really cool technologies and knowledge for you to go create it. And you might be able to do it, or you can use those tools and technologies to go find it. And that's what our company's mission is, really, is that we just believe there's hidden things in the world. And if we seek them out with pure motives, then we'll find them. And that's what we're doing. We're using all the technological advancements today to then go find it and then make it available.
So what do you think about another grain, you know, that's kind of top of mind when we talk about health, is particularly, you know, wheat. And what's happened to wheat historically over time and more recently, and the contribution of these, you know, wheat proteins, gluten, gliadin. How should we be looking at wheat today? I mean, can we use some of the tools that you're talking about and try to find ways to find a strain or to breed a strain so there's less of these problematic proteins? Because, you know, right now it's reached this kind of level of almost, I would almost describe it as overreaction hysteria in the in the healthcare community about this is what's causing, and I'm all, you know, I have to have a gluten-free diet. Well, that's not necessarily the complete truth. It may contribute a little bit to some people, but not everybody. But how do you think we should be looking about solving this issue?
I mean, I think, John, wheat is an interesting one for me because, I mean, wheat has been a staple of the human diet from the onset, right? I mean, wheat—it's biblical. It's biblical in its proportions. It's the origin, right? I mean, wheat and humans have been together from the get-go, is what I like to say, right? And so I look at it and say, well, so you know, what's the deal, right? Like, I mean, I don't think you want to throw wheat out, right? I think it's a staple of I think it'd be a tragedy to remove wheat from the human diet, especially based it's an origin species with human being. I think, you know, one of the things that we, you ask, can we use the tool sets to do some things to help in some of the areas where we've, we had a need, right, to utilize wheat and an industrial need to make it cheap. And I think we want to go back and demonize these big organizations and say, well, they're bad. They're causing this in me. They're making things horrible. You know, just take a step back and say one of the things they've done is made food really accessible and cheap. You know, if we go back in time, not too long ago, I mean, my great grandfather, food was not cheap and easy. And people died from not having enough food. And there's places on the planet where that still happens. And I always say these are first world arguments, but I think we need to look at some of the good things they're doing. And they've been doing a lot of work on trying to eliminate this kind of thing. Some of these entities that utilize wheat, they've been doing a lot of work to kind of get at the bottom of these things. They've done a lot of really intrinsic studies that have shown, you know, why that's happened and how do we combat it. The struggle is now is how do you combat it while keeping food safe and cheap? And so I think the answer, as you're saying, is you can use these tools. And I think you have to use all the tools in your tool belt because it is real. And it's a two-part problem. I think one part is we have to do a really good job of trying to bring back the genetics to go back and figure out, are there strains that are less caustic that actually work in a system that can produce that food safely and cheaply, that wheat in such ways that they can stay on shelves for a long time and do these things. That's one way to do it that takes time and they need to be worked on. And then the other thing that people are doing is they're trying to take a more radical approach where they're trying to eliminate the epitopes, they call them, these things that cause reactions in human beings, to get rid of those with kind of technologies like the GMO technologies or things like that. Now, most of the major food players in the world don't want that. Right. So the first answer that I gave is the answer that they are starting to seek after. So doing that is the smart thing to do. And then the educational component, right? Because there is this thing where we all feel it. We have things that we think that's happening, that there's that element in there. And I get nervous or stressed out about it being there, and it causes a psychological response that causes us to have IBS, right? And so there's both pieces. I think it's it's a self-perpetuating problem that we have to fix both things. And I think so re-education while solving the problem, but not just saying, I think what happened is it's almost like become a political issue. It's like polarized both ends, yeah, right, John? It's right, like, yeah. So the science has gotten us here. It's happened. Right. And now I'm feeling it. And they're not listening to me, and I'm not listening to them now because you're bad. Well, you're bad, yeah. And you're dumb, and you're dumb. Right. And that's the argument that we've gotten to, and it's not a good place. It's coming to the place where everybody's listening to everybody, I think, and then we're making meaningful change, but the groups are being educated along the ways. And I think the Celiac's Foundation, all these people are working with some of these big consumers, based companies, and they're working at that solution. But again, I think going back to our earlier conversation, we live in a great time where all the tool sets are there, all the multidisciplinary sciences can come together. Right. We have a lot of really, really smart institutions.
Right. And actually, I think you make such an important point, is that the solutions are actually at our fingertips, where we don't have to argue a point anymore. We need to take action.
Exactly.
And the action really is that with the technology that's available today, well, let's do something about it.
Yeah.
Let's actually focus on things like specialty farming, organic farming in some cases where it makes a difference, and take the best that science has to offer and grow great nutrient-dense, phyto-dense plants that can actually be put into the food system again that'll keep people healthy.
Well, exactly, because I think you make a case there early on. I think even within your company, it's the idea that your food is a drug, right?
Yeah.
Like literally food is, we put it into our body. It's the one thing we put into our body and it's the fuel for our body. And if you put bad fuel in a car, you're gonna get bad things.
Yeah, you'll get knocks, right?
Yeah, you're gonna get knocks, right? And I think that's the thing that's missed, especially as we have a growing population. Healthcare is not sustainable, John.
The way it is today
is not sustainable, regardless of what side of the fence you're on in the healthcare argument.
Yeah.
And I personally can be pretty conservative, but I'm still not gonna stand there and say, this is sustainable.
Right.
Like, because it's not. You can't just have a cheeseburger and all this fat and everything else in your diet and go take a pill.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Like, I'm sorry, but that's not the solution.
Right.
And it's not the good solution, right? And the answer is, it's really, we have to take a long, hard look as we have a scaling population and say, we have all the tools to go back.
Step up to the plate.
Yeah,
and
create meaningful change.
Right.
This is a global grand challenge. It's not just a developing world problem. It's a real world problem. It's an our world problem. And I think we have to step up and say, okay, let's go and take all the tool sets we have, take all the discipline we have, and let's go take on this challenge and start producing, like you're saying, food that is really, really good for us, right? That has all the phytonutrients and all the things grown in a way that we can render cheaply and affordably for everybody, that they can have it and take it in. And imagine what world that will create.
Right.
A world where I think in some cases, I thought this, you know, people, when I watch these zombie apocalypse movies, you know, the silent zombie apocalypse might be the fact that we're feeding ourselves starch and hollow calories.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right. That might be the true zombie apocalypse, right? Yeah. Because the fact is, we're not getting really good fuel. We're not getting the right fats. We're not getting these things in our diet, and our brains aren't developing to where they could.
Somewhere along the way, either because of the choices of foodstuffs that we consume, or just they're not available anymore, is the high quality, for example, energy sources, high quality carbohydrates are harder to find these days.
Yeah,
but with, you know,
expensive.
The science that you have, you know, it's possible to make sure that they are available in the right plants.
Right.
And I think that if we can solve that.
And if they're in the plants and we can create the yield and we can make them affordable to these engines, like these big corporate engines that produce a lot of reliable, safe food. We forget that safe and reliable in a way that we can store it and eat it. If we could do that, John, then their food source becomes very, very good, right? And they're not, their angle is not to create low quality fuel for the engines that exist.
Right.
It's just, how do we do it in such a way that it's affordable and we're giving everybody what they need?
Right.
And again, society is only gonna improve or get better if everybody on the planet has the fuel source they need. And I think every voice on the planet is a conversation that needs to be added, or needs to be added to this global conversation.
Absolutely. Well, that voice, that learning and listening component, combined with the great plant genomics, nutrigenomics that you and your scientific capabilities that you're bringing to the marketplace, is probably the most effective pathway forward that we have to actually achieve that.
I don't know, John. I think we have a lot of scientists that they don't care about anymore making $1 million. They care about making the world a better place, awesome, which, right? I think that's pretty cool.
That's kind of at the end of the day, what healthcare actually needs to focus on is exactly. We're taking care of our fellow humans.
That's right.
Keeping
that's right.
as healthy as they can. Yeah. So Dr. Eric Jackson, thanks very much for taking the time with us today and shedding light on what the real story is about plants, plant genomics, and especially the concept of plant anthropology. It's fascinating insight that is balanced and the first balanced approach that we heard in quite some time. So thanks very much for taking the time.
Yeah. Appreciate you.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
This podcast features the song New Day by Lee Rosevere, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. If you liked this podcast, please share with your friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. We'll see you next time on Holistic Matters, where we are talking about how to be the you nature intended.